Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. A recent attack into Israel proper by Hamas fighters reignited an ages-long battle, dividing the world into two camps, those supporting Israel and those supporting Palestine. But is the conflict really that binary, or is the nuance behind it all really what should be discussed? Today, we'll break down the humanitarian disaster that is Gaza that could only widen as outside intervention steps in, and explore aspects that the mainstream media won't discuss. All right, let's get into the MO. Depending on the lenses you wear, you will either see a David and Goliath story in Gaza or a surprise terrorist attack into its peaceful neighbor of Israel. It seems the world is divided on this much in the same way it was over Ukraine. There's debate over intelligence failures, outside third-party funding or planning, who backs whom, and the oversimplification of good versus evil. There's even as much a media and messaging war as there is physical violence when discussing the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Now, an important distinction that must be made immediately is that Hamas is not a country, rather a political faction among the Palestinian population, primarily in the Gaza Strip, that was a counterweight or opposition party to the West Bank's Fatah ruling party in the Palestinian parliamentary system. So when Israel says they are fighting Hamas, it's because they have labeled Hamas a terror organization. So in effect, then, Israel's declaration of war against Hamas is a declaration of war on terror. You may remember the same declaration made by George W. Bush after 9/11. In fact, over and over, we've heard Israeli officials declare this their 9/11, borrowing the same Bush-era nebulous rhetoric. So for more on this, we will turn to Sam Husseini, an independent journalist who's been covering this topic for many years. You can see more of Sam's work by going to husseini.substack.com. Sam, thank you so much for joining me. First, let's address the events that unfolded on October 7th, which sparked this volley of violence thereafter. How did Hamas manage this incursion into Israel proper, including, you know, paragliding into this music festival where many partygoers were killed? I mean, isn't Israeli airspace and their territory just about as heavily surveilled and monitored, I mean, comparable to the airspace here in Washington, D.C.? I mean, was this a massive intelligence failure?
Well, a couple of questions there. First off, on the hand gliding, I haven't heard anybody note. I've heard stories that the first intifada back in 1987 was triggered by a hang glider, an independent person, not affiliated with any group, flew into a some kind of Israeli military facility or something. I don't know exactly what happened there, but there is a deep history in terms of Palestinians using hang gliders. I don't know how many people are aware of that, even potentially the people who organized this operation. It was obviously a very well-planned, or it seems to have been a very well-planned operation. I mean, to compare it to the airspace around Washington, D.C. is a little bit wrong because, I mean, Gaza is very unique in that it has basically been under a siege by Israel for at least a decade and a half now. I mean, there's no airport in Gaza. Why is there no airport? Because they built an airport in the late 90s and then Israel blew it up in 2001. So for, you know, the way that people talk about Gaza doesn't, a lot of it doesn't understand the devastation and the strangulation and the deprivation that people in Gaza have suffered. But this was obviously a well-planned operation. From my point of view, it was brilliant in terms of what they seem to have done in terms of taking on the Israeli military, the much vaunted Israeli military, and incredibly tragic in their apparent targeting as well of civilians. Although I think that a great deal of what was done to civilians has been exaggerated, at least as of what we know now. In terms of these claims of, butchering babies and potentially rapes and so on. There's a long history of finding pretexts for war and devastation based on, fabrications around, baby incubators with the first Iraq war and so on. So there could be a huge disinformation aspect of it. Another big question, which I think does merit investigation, is to what extent this was such a major intelligence failure. Israel apparently got warnings from the Egyptians that something big was coming. And Hamas, in their statement, nobody's paying attention to the statements from Hamas. I put out a thing about their webpage being ignored. I was the first person to post their statement on Twitter, which I'm now suspended from for apparently irrelevant, unrelated reasons, just simply as a reporter saying, look, this is what Hamas says their justification is. And in their statement, they say that it was to, that they had warned Israel, that they say, despite repeated warnings, the Israelis wouldn't heed them, and so we carried out this operation. So either it was an incredible intelligence failure by Israel, or there was some kind of stand down. One thinks of what many people claim FDR did regarding Pearl Harbor, that he effectively let Pearl Harbor happen in order to draw the U.S. into a World War II. It may be the case that Netanyahu, who has been diabolical and a serial liar and murderer, wants to find a pretext to, devastate Gaza, potentially even do a mass expulsion of Palestinians, as he has advocated in the past. In 1989, Netanyahu said that Israel should take advantage of the Tiananmen Square massacre to carry out an expulsion. So that's my read of the immediate situation.
Right. To your point about FDR, the same has been said about George W. Bush and 9/11. I mean, the warnings, the red flags were there, but seemingly ignored. Now, let's get into the why. Why did Hamas decide to strike, and why now? And do you think this will lead to the third Intifada?
It's hard to get into people's heads. I mean, certainly Israel's stated goals of, protecting Israelis and protecting Jews, I think, are false. They're not doing that. If they did want to protect Israelis and did want to protect Jews, they would have agreed to a reasonable peace years ago, and wouldn't have fostered Hamas. There's a big history there of Israel building up Hamas starting in the 1980s, kind of like the U.S. built up the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, what would become the Taliban. And they did that to split the Palestinian ranks to undermine the secular PLO at the time. And even recent statements, Netanyahu's been saying stuff like, we got to fund Hamas. Within the last couple of years. But in terms of Hamas's motives, again, I don't, it's difficult to get into people's heads, particularly political actors who might have Machiavellian motives in mind. I think a lot of people hope that this sparks another intifada, and it might, And, you know, the Palestinians have repeatedly done these uprisings in order to push forward their quest for justice and independence. And that is certainly laudable in and of itself. But, you know, Hamas, you know, may well have other motives in terms of their own political dynamics. They seem to have succeeded, if one regards this as an intelligence failure by Israel, in making Israel think that they were just interested in some, you know, minor, you know, getting whatever breadcrumbs of economic development the Israelis might grant them in their great benevolence, and seem to have, you know, psyched out the Israelis and, in effect, you know, totally up the ante in terms of their military struggle. And many people view Hamas as a legitimate resistance group. And I think that there's some credence to that, but I think just on an ethical level, the targeting of civilians at a music festival, at least at a moral level, if not a legal level, is, you know, incredibly problematic, to say the least. So it's not clear what Hamas's motives are, to me. You know, I don't doubt that many people in Hamas are genuinely driven by a incredible frustration and anger at the at what Israel is doing to them, at with bombings and siege and deprivation over all these years, and what the U.S. has facilitated and backed and financed from Israel, and the fact that the global, you know, the international community has done nothing to stop it, and indeed that Israel has been on a rampage in terms of normalizing with the U.S.'s help with these Arab dictatorships, with the so-called Abraham Accords under Trump, and this process continues under Biden. It's met some of the same people at the State Department under both allegedly at loggerheads administrations. They completely agree on this, and they work hand in glove in order to strangle the Palestinians and to try to normalize relations between Israel. So I can imagine that Hamas saw that they were becoming more isolated, and they were even talking about Saudi Arabia normalizing relations. And of course, Saudi Arabia's U.S. client partner as well in their violence against Yemen, so it kind of makes sense. So Hamas may well have made this move in order to sort of grab the initiative so that they won't be completely at Israel's mercy once Israel completes this normalization process. You even had Erdogan, the Turkish president, meet with Netanyahu for the first time ever recently. So the isolation was increasing. And so I think that that might have pushed Hamas in order to grab the initiative from their point of view.
Coming up next, the internal battles between the Palestinian territories, Gaza and the West Bank. Hamas on one side and the Palestinian Authority on the other. We'll discuss it when we return with Sam Husseini. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays, on est en France quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to The MO. I'm Manila Chan. Prior to the tragic events in early October, Saudi Arabia was in the process of normalizing relations with Israel. That's all off the table now. Sam Husseini is back to continue the conversation. Sam, thanks for sticking around. So we've seen a lot of Western media conflate Hamas with Palestinian civilians in Gaza, perhaps deliberately. How important is that distinction, and also the distinction between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority?
It's tremendously important to make the distinctions between Hamas and the Palestinian civilians and the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian Authority effectively presides over a surrender government in the West Bank, the area sort of between Israel and Jordan, or parts of it. They don't even have the whole thing. And they basically do what Israel says. They're just sort of a surrender government, Vichy government, like a government installed by the Nazis in France during World War II. Hamas came to power because they won an election in 2006. And I think they won the election for reasons that are not well understood. This was in the aftermath of Yasser Arafat's death, possible assassination by the Israelis. And I think that the Palestinian people partially elected Hamas at that point to say, we are one people. And you're not going to divide us between people in Gaza, the West Bank, the refugees in southern Lebanon, and the greater, population of Palestinians around the world. So that's how Hamas came to power. And people, even irrespective of this attack and so on, I mean, Hamas had a legitimacy crisis in terms of they weren't doing resistance, and they were setting up their own structures that were somewhat delivering, because they have a network, because Israel helped them build up a network of health clinics and so on in the 1980s in order to undermine the PLO. But there's been some frustration among Palestinians in terms of, what does Hamas really deliver? Just as there is from the PA sitting there in Ramallah, which is far better off than the rest of the Palestinian territories. There are some Palestinian movements which are independent. For example, there's Marwan Barghouti with the Palestine National Initiative. I think he's a voice with some legitimacy, but he's not backed by U.S. funding or by religious zealotry. And I should say other Palestinians who have attempted, for example, you have a figure like Mubarak Awad, who is a nonviolent activist who helped spark the first intifada in the 1980s. You know what Israel did to him? They expelled him. Get the hell out of here. We don't want your guy nonviolence. Whenever Israel says, we have to deal with this Hamas. Yeah, well, you expelled all of these people who attempted to, organize nonviolently to end the occupation. And so then you end up with the groups that are most prone to committing violence who you yourself backed. So in the current context, it is appalling that the U.S. media is, and many others are, minimizing the devastation towards the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza, just as they've been ignoring the repeated Israeli attacks on the West Bank the last several months, and that they are justifying it effectively by pointing to alleged by saying, oh, they're going after Hamas. They're not going after Hamas. Israel does not want peace. Israel is not trying to protect its civilian population. If Netanyahu wanted to protect his civilian population, he would have made a reasonable peace deal. He has had numerous opportunities. He has always been expansionist. He has always been militaristic. He has not wanted peace. He has not wanted the safety of Israeli citizens or of Jews in general.
So do you think the election of Hamas was a knee-jerk reaction to this perceived weakness of the PA and then, of course, the death of Arafat back in 2004?
Arafat died in 2004, and the people that, and Arafat had a lot of problems, but he effectively represented Palestinians in their multi dimensions, both in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Israel proper. There are lots of Palestinians, Christians, and Muslims in what is now Israel proper, and in refugees in southern Lebanon, in Jordan, and around the world. So with him gone, and with what was obvious, a corrupt leadership in the Palestinian Authority that was in effect colluding with Israel and effectively becoming their thug, working against Palestinian activists, you know, who are trying to organize for Palestinian liberation, the PA would go after them. So they were just doing the Israelis' bidding. So, you know, forced to choose between that and Hamas, which, was in effect saying, we're all one Palestinian people and we want to liberate everything. And yeah, we're religious zealots, but we're actually delivering health and food and medicine and so on to the population. They have a network of mosques and so on. So the Palestinian people chose that in that context, and it was a lousy choice, but I think of quite an understandable one.
Prior to October 7, the Saudis and the Israelis were at the threshold of normalizing relations. I mean, this after the Saudis just restored diplomatic ties with Iran. The former allegedly left the Palestinian Authority feeling abandoned or like the Saudis had turned their backs on Palestine. Is there any truth or reality to those sentiments?
It's not clear. Obviously Saudi Arabia and their current ruler, MBS, are not ethical operators. But they have probably to have some, I mean, they're engaging in their own devastation of Yemen, for example, and the U.S. said that they would make MBS a pariah because of his killing of Khashoggi and so on, but obviously haven't done that. The U.S. in effect is has backed both atrocities by Israel and by Saudi Arabia. You do have Saudi Arabia and there was about 20 years ago a developing Egyptian Saudi Iranian grouping that was emerging, and the U.S. and Israel managed to undermine that then, so that could be reformulating. And you interestingly had China broker normalization, I understand, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I do have some concerns about this, and I was meaning to raise this earlier. You have countries like Iran profess their support of the Palestinians, and I don't doubt that Iran supplies Hezbollah with material and quite possibly Hamas. I'm not an expert on that, but that's certainly possible. But they have not done all they can, in my view, legitimately, in terms of backing the Palestinian cause. For example, right now you have the PA even saying that, charging that you have genocide going on here. You certainly have genocidal rhetoric from the Israeli camp against the Palestinians. You know, no food, no medicine, no electricity, no water. You know, blow you up, and the death toll is rising by the day. And there doesn't seem to be any breaks on what Israel is capable of here. And you even had, in the 2014 attack on Gaza, you had Iranians and Venezuelans and Bolivian leaders and Pakistani leaders say that Israel was committing genocide even at that point, and this may well be worse than that. There's a genocide convention. They can invoke this at the United Nations. It's my understanding that that this was not done because the Palestinian Authority at the United Nations asked that it not be done because they were still trying to play footsie with the Israelis. Now, that may change now. The PA may decide to get real and stop playing footsie with the Israelis and allow Iran or Venezuela or Bolivia or any other, or Russia or any other country to say, let's, you know, put in place some legal safeguards here. Israel and the United States have tied up the International Criminal Court, which should be taking care of this. But when you have a scale that can be approaching genocide, and there's very specific legal definitions of genocide, you don't need to have a industrialized system of exterminating people and onions and so on. Many lawyers have spoken out about this, the late Michael Ratner of Center for Constitutional Rights, Francis Boyle at the University of Illinois, and other legal scholars have laid out the case that you can invoke the Genocide Convention here. And I think that this is something that governments who claim to be in solidarity with the Palestinians around the world can and should do, regardless of what the PLO office at the United Nations says, because they're not representing the Palestinian people here very effectively at all. So I think that that's a major thing that is totally underutilized in terms of how to actually create a framework for a solution here.
Yeah, so much to unpack, but unfortunately we have to leave it right there. Sam Husseini, thank you so much. Be sure to subscribe to Sam's work at husseini.substack.com.
Thank you.
All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.